Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
About buying a home, but don't have the first clue of what to do? Call Mary Gill now on Real Estate 101, 404-892-2703. News and Talk 1380 WAOK.
We're back, everyone. News and Talk 1380 WAOK, Real Estate 101. I'm Mary Gill. And as I mentioned earlier, we do have our guests on the line. I'm really excited for them to be with me today. They actually started out in real estate. One, who's my really good friend. And we're going to talk a little bit about that because his search and his wife's search actually encompasses so much of what I tried to convey on the show, and they actually knew most of it and just came in, and I was able to help them achieve their goals. So I love that, and I want you to hear that part of it. But then also, both of these gentlemen are just fantastic. I can't even do it justice with how I want to describe them. I'm going to go over part of their bios, but I can't even begin to tell you the things that they've accomplished over the duration of their law enforcement careers. I just can't. So what I'm doing is I'm going to screenshot these. I'm going to post them to Real Estate 101 featuring Mary Gill so you can read it yourself. They, to be at this juncture in their life, retired and now venturing off into something that our society needs most today, and that is actually training leaders, is just phenomenal, especially for us, our community. We need someone who can understand our experience to be in a position to train leaders who have to deal with our people every day. All right. Okay, so let me see. I'll start with my longtime friend of 20 years. His name is Eduardo Alford, otherwise known as Eddie. He's from North Carolina and attended North Carolina University in Raleigh, where he earned a Bachelor of Arts in Business Management. Upon graduating, he started his career as a police officer with the Prince William County Police Department in Woodbridge, Virginia. Then, furthering his career, he accepted a position in 1988 as an appointment as a special agent with the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigations. He worked a variety of investigations, including homicide, drug arson, financial crimes, and was a member of the SWAT team. He also worked DEA task force and was which fueled his interest in law enforcement. In 1992, he accepted a position as a special agent with the FBI. And I will let you, from that point on, we will talk to Agent Alford, or Special Agent Alford, about his career from that point on. I wanted to give you a little bit of background. Now, let me go to Dr. Green. I'm really excited about Dr. Green being with us as well. Dr. Gerald D. Green is a 27-year-old law enforcement officer. Began his career as a police officer with the DeKalb County, Georgia Police Department. He now has 20, and then in addition to that, now has 21 years as a Federal Bureau of Investigation Special Agent and a Supervisory Special Agent. As a special agent, he served in the Richmond Division, where he successfully investigated white-collar crime, violent crime, and major offenders and other criminal matters. While in Richmond, he successfully coordinated and managed a multi-task force and dismantled a violent multi-jurisdictional national drug organization. Wow, that's amazing. I'm going to go further down and let's talk about his education a little bit. He's a graduate of Abraham Baldwin Agricultural College and Georgia State University with degrees in criminal justice. He completed Georgia Command College and earned a master's degree in public administration from Columbia State University in December 2006 and then in 2019. He graduated from Regent University School of Business and Leadership with a doctorate of strategic leadership. He also served honorably in the United States Army for 3 years. So guys, we have a wealth of information available to us today. He's retired from the FBI and is currently an independent consultant. He was an instructor and taught at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia. And in this position, he was a facilitator and instructor for a number of human intelligence integrated targeting courses. Everybody, please help me in welcoming to the show Eddie Alford, Special Agent Eddie Alford, and Dr. Gerald D. Green. Thank you. Thank you. Gentlemen.
Mary, hello. How are you?
I'm doing good. So do we have both of you there?
I think Dr. Green is on.
Can you hear me? Do you have him, Eddie?
Well, he was on before I called in.
All right. Well, let's start with you. He'll call you probably.
Hold on. I'm here. I'm here. Can you hear me now?
Yes. How are you doing?
I'm finding a little technically challenged, but I got it.
Oh, listen. Join the club. I have my 13-year-old granddaughter here. She's my tech assistant during my shows. All right, so I introduced both of you to the show, and everybody knows about your educational history and your background as well. So they pretty much know about you up to the point of you both joining the FBI. I wanted to initially, though, Dr. Green, if you would allow us to, I want to talk a little bit with Special Agent Alford, who I know fondly as Eddie, because I love his whole family, but how we met with real estate and some of the specific things, Eddie, which I really try to convey to my listening audience, that you were looking for and you wanted to inculcate into your purchase, and how over the years, you know, these are the things that you wanted to accomplish, and we've been able to do it. So let's talk about way back. I mean, oh God, your kids were little.
Right, they were.
Sammy was a baby, pretty much.
He was a baby. I think right around 2 years old.
He's so cute. Anyway, all right. So initially, you guys came to Atlanta to look for a house.
Yes.
Way back in the day. All right. Let's tell everybody about how that happened. What were you doing? Where were you in the FBI at that point? I mean, you had just been there in the FBI a few years, right?
Right. I think currently at that time, Mary, I was in Richmond, actually. I hadn't met Dr. Green, but I was in the Richmond office, and you know, there was an opportunity that we were potentially going to get transferred down to Atlanta. So we, you know, you move around a lot. And then typically with government, you know, contract, you know, people that work for the government, you know, we all try to purchase homes, and it's pretty much a guarantee, you know, because of the programs that we have, you know, within our own agency. So I always like to, you know, request, you know, an agent of color. I'll leave it at that. So I put the request in, and I felt like it had been honored. But I got to say, when I saw you, we were sitting in the car, and I saw you drive up. The first question I had was, I thought they were sending me a lady of color. And little did I know how much of a lady of color you turned out to be.
So, yes, I fool people sometimes. Sometimes I fool people like that.
Exactly. Oh. But then the other thing of interest was, at the time, schools. We, you know, I had two young sons. So one of the things that I was very interested in was school districts. You know, where were the good school districts? You know, and I wanted to be very specific about finding housing in those areas.
So you ultimately ended up not getting transferred here.
Exactly.
And exactly. But over all of those years, and ultimately until you did get transferred here, this is the importance of having a good relationship with a real estate agent, because no matter where you were, Eddie, you called me when you had questions.
I did. And then I also relied heavily, Mary, because I was so impressed, you know, with your knowledge of housing, how the process works, how to get, you know, loans, all the intricate things that, you know, I think that oftentimes people don't really know what to ask for and what to look for. So we had gotten such a tremendous knowledge base just from the time that we had spent and talked to you. I basically carried that around to all the other 8 states that I lived in before I ultimately got to Atlanta. And I believe, Mary, correct me if I'm wrong, I think what I did was I would call you every time and I'd have you recommend an agent for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I would purchase homes in those areas. And then ultimately I was able to come back to Atlanta and actually finally purchased a home with you.
Right. Yes, yes, yes. We were really, I was so happy that you guys were finally here. It was really nice. But we established a really good friendship over the years. And that's really important, is to network and to have access to knowledge in various different areas. I think, like, you guys now have me in real estate and I have you, and anything that I need is FBI related. So I haven't had to use that card yet, but it's still out there. Thank God. All right, everybody. So we're excited. 404-892-2703. You guys, listen, call in. If you have questions, we're going to be running the gamut from traffic stops to training leaders. And these guys they know it all. So please feel free to give us a call, 404-892-2703. We have Edward Alford, a special agent, Edward Alford, retired with the FBI, and Dr. Gerald Green. He is also retired with the FBI, and now they're looking to train leaders. Real Estate 101, Mary Gill, back after the break.
Bad trees, you go to school and learn the golden rule. So why are you acting like a bloody fool?
We're back, everyone. News and Talk 1380 WAOK, Real Estate 101. I'm Mary Gill. And only because I've been granted a fantastic opportunity to interview 2 and possibly 3, if we can get him on, former special FBI agents who are now taking this to another level now that they're retired, so that they can actually put themselves in a position to train leaders so that they can deal with our demographic and the general public effectively. We have Dr. Gerald D. Green, 27-year law enforcement officer, and Special Agent Eduardo Eddie Alford, who is retired with the FBI. So, gentlemen, thank you. All right, so Eddie, what I want to do so that we can segue into Dr. Green is tell us a little bit about your career and then when you met Dr. Green, and then how did you all ultimately over the years come to the idea that you wanted to collaborate on this?
So before I get there, Mary, I want to also, on the call with us is another good friend of mine. I actually met this gentleman my very first day back in April of 1992. I was walking into Quantico, and this brother walked up to me and shook his hand and introduced himself, said hello. And his name was Quentin Williams. So I have Quentin on the line with us too, Mary, and I know you and I have talked about Quentin over the years. And when after I talk about Dr. Green, I'd like to have Quentin just say a couple of things to your listeners about what he and I do collectively and involve Dr. Green as well. So
yeah, I would love that. Everybody, thank you. I'm glad he was able to come on. Everybody, please welcome to the show Quentin Williams. He is the author of The Survival Guide, How Not to Get Killed by the Police. Thank you for joining us, Agent Williams. We appreciate that. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. All right, Eddie. So this is a special treat. And the only reason I know how special it is because when I came to your retirement party, you know, we as a general public, and even your friends, have no idea how limited Black FBI agents are. And when you had your retirement party, there were just, you said most of them in the country are right here.
Yeah. No, they were. I mean, you know, the numbers, you know, unfortunately, were larger back when I started. The numbers have kind of dwindled a little bit now, Mary, and that just speaks to other things. But what ultimately happened to get to, you know, kind of where I am and the thing you talked about, those same two young boys that you met, you know, over 20 years ago are now driving. So I get a call one day from Quentin, I call him Q, and he says, hey, man, I'm going to write a book because there are variable things that, as an African-American agent, you still are an African-American. So, you know, over the years, Mary, I can tell you I was stopped by police officers, profiled, you know, it ran the gamut. Same thing happened to Quentin, and the same things happened to Dr. Green. You know, just because of the jobs that we had, that did not take away the fact that we were still African-American males living living in communities, living in societies. We do the jobs that we were doing then because we cared about people. So you called me about joining him with something that he had been thinking about for years, and it involved traffic stops. And at that time, Mary, it was a lot of things were happening, kind of like what's happening now. It kind of goes in waves. But a lot of African-American men were being shot, killed, you know, in these traffic stops. So we wanted to put our resources together and do something about it. So he wrote his book. I won't steal his thunder about the book, but that work, you know, in that space was personal to me because now I'm not only an FBI agent, but I'm also a father. And I'm also the father of two young men who are going to be in communities driving vehicles. So I was very passionate about wanting to join that fight because I wanted not only to keep my sons safe, but everybody else's sons too that looked like them, looked like me.
Right.
You know, so that led to, you know, the work, some of the work that we're doing. And then I met Dr. Green, and now Dr. Green is in that same space as it relates to training leaders in these various departments around the United States. And that's kind of the space where Quentin and I are as well. So,
okay. So, I guess I got two different places to start here. I guess I'll start with you, Quentin, in reference to your book, that's Boots on the Ground. And then as far as being out there, public contact, and then I want to go to Dr. Green and his book as well, because that's going to be hugely important with training leaders. So, Quentin, when you called Eddie and when you had this brainstorm, was there anything that actually precipitated that? I mean, any specific incident or what made you come to that realization that you wanted to do that?
Well, thanks for the question. It's a great question. And yes, there were a series of incidents that precipitated my need to write this book. I'd been stopped over the course of 10 years, I've been stopped about 10 times, once per year on average, by state troopers as I was going up and down I-95 from Charlotte to New York. And during those stops, my wife at the time would say to me, "You are doing something that not many people know how to do." And what she was talking about was that I was able to, in 2 to 3 minutes, diffuse the situation, make the trooper feel safe, and we were all on our merry way. They were stopping me for drug interdictions. And so my wife at the time was not necessarily happy about it. She didn't understand what that meant necessarily. I did, because I was law enforcement. And so as I calm her down, I take care of the traffic stop, and then she tells me, "You're doing something that not many people know." So about the 10th time in 10 years, she said, "You need to write a book about what you do." And I said, "I'm not writing a book. I don't have enough time. I was building businesses." She was pregnant at the time, 3 months pregnant. She said to me, she knew she was having a boy. We hadn't had an ultrasound at that point yet, but she felt this maternal instinct leading her to that conclusion, that she was having a boy. And she said, "Write this book for our son." And I said, what do you mean, son? She said, "I know I'm having a boy. Write this book for him." And, you know, Mary, that's the ace card. She saved it up and she pulled it out. And because of that, I wrote an essay to my son. In 2 weekends, I wrote an essay. And I told him about my stories of being pulled over, about being arrested. I was arrested when I was an FBI agent because I fit the description of somebody. And I told those stories in the context of teaching the audience that's going to read it about how to handle these situations and then what to do afterward.
Okay.
And then after I wrote the book, my son was born 6 months later. She was right. And I was going to have a conversation with him when he turned 8 years old about how to engage with the police, how to build substantive relationships. He turns 8 in another couple months. I wrote this book over 8 years ago for him as just essay from a father. And then because of Trayvon, Michael Brown, Eric Garner, she said, my former wife said, "You need to release that book to the public because you'll probably save some lives." And I did that, and that's when the firestorm began. Everybody was writing to me, mothers and fathers and grandparents, about how this was helping them because it was giving them the initial contact with their kids to have this conversation.
Have the conversation, right.
Yeah.
Okay, I've got to take a break. I've got to go to a break, but thank you. This is fantastic. I appreciate it. I have with me Quentin Williams. He's the author of The Survival Guide, How Not to Get Killed by the Police. Dr. Gerald Green, his book on coaching leaders. And then Special Agent Edward Alford, who they've all been with or currently with the FBI. News and Talk 1380 WAOK. Back in a minute. Welcome back, everyone. News and Talk 1380 WAOK. Real Estate 101. I'm Mary Gill. We have Quentin Williams, special agent with the FBI, wrote a survival guide, How Not to Get Killed by the Police. Also joining us is Eddie Alford, special agent Eddie Alford, retired with the FBI and now working security for a large company. And then also Dr. Gerald Green, who wrote a book about training leadership. So what I would like to do, I'm going to take a caller. We have a caller holding. But what I would like to do, Agent Williams, if you don't mind, is I initially want to give the listening audience the ability to access your book. I downloaded and got on Kindle Dr. Green's book, and I want everybody to know how to get yours. Eddie gave me a copy of yours, but it's not the general public can't access my copy, so I want them to be able to access yours. So we're going to do that when we come back, right after talking to this caller. You got it there, Jamin? Okay. Hey, Mary?
Yes, I'm here.
How are you today?
I'm great, thank you. How are you?
Good. What's going on?
Yeah, so my question was in regards to a specific incident that happened this week with NASCAR. I really wanted to know maybe some inside information on how that investigation was conducted. I'm curious to know, because now that NASCAR has released an actual photo, it just seems like that the report that they released isn't necessarily contradictory, but it just seems that I'm not sure how they came to the conclusion that they came to. And then NASCAR, obviously, because of PR reasons, released a photo that clearly shows a noose. So just curious as to how that investigation was conducted.
All right. Well, I'm going to let any one of the three guests today speak to that if any of you want to chime in on your opinions. Nobody? Cricket?
I can let Eddie or Donnie if they want to. I can say that we do not know the particulars of the investigation because we're no longer agents. But it is obvious that there was a noose-like rope that was affixed to the garage, and I'm sure that the investigation is continuing. The FBI did investigate it with a team, but I wouldn't necessarily say that that investigation is closed. I don't know if it's NASCAR is continuing to investigate it, but I would assume they are.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's the thing is that these FBI agents they're not currently actively working on investigations with the FBI because they're retired. So they're kind of in their retirement now moving towards something hugely significant, and that is training, which leadership desperately needs, and then also just safeguarding people and our children and young folks and I guess everybody on the street when they get stopped by the police. So, gentlemen, I'm going to talk to all of you, but I had a conversation earlier this week with an Atlanta police officer, and he's black. He's retired. So, I had fantastic conversations with him in the past, but now, you know, this one kind of didn't go that well because he was justifying the use of police force with the in a number of situations. So that didn't go really well. But one thing I did want to say, and this is one thing I want to say to you, and which I reason why I appreciate what you all are doing, is because the final thing I had to say to him is this, and this is just to me a fundamental truth, is that now everybody's afraid they're going to get killed. I mean, I'm afraid I'm going to get killed. I'm afraid for my nieces and my nephews. I think they're going to get killed. And it wasn't his perception. And he's a black retired police officer that if you get stopped, your first inclination these days is that you could potentially get killed. But that, to me, is what we think. Is that not the case? I mean, it has to be the case with you, Special Agent Williams, because you wrote the book. I mean, I'm afraid we're going to get killed.
Yes. Well, so this perception becomes reality for many people. And although I still, I stay strong to my position that the vast majority of law enforcement officers are hardworking, dedicated individuals who are sacrificing and serving, putting on a vest in every morning to step in front of a bullet that's intended for somebody they don't even know. They are willing to do that. There is a small number of folks who get into the industry who should not be officers of the law. They shouldn't. And those people need to be removed because they are not necessarily making mistakes. There is a recklessness about the way they behave or a deliberate attempt to do something that is wrong. That's the case in every industry. But in law enforcement, if you do it, it's a matter of life and death. So it's incumbent upon those who are in the industry to weed those people out. And it's also incumbent upon the public to make folks accountable, which is why I say if something happens, you're treated unprofessionally, make sure you report it. Do not let it go unnoticed. Report it at every level, from state to federal.
So, all right, we're going to go to break. When we come back, I would like to go over and talk to Dr. Green, because now we're talking about the police force. And how do you make that selection? And how do you train the leaders to train their staff to even treat some people like humans? How do you train that? So that's what I want to get to Dr. Green. How, to me, you can't train compassion, but I do believe you can hold these officers to a high standard. So I want to talk to you about that when we come back. If you have any questions for these retired FBI agents, please give us a call, 404-892-2703. Real Estate 101, back in a minute. Welcome back, everyone. News and Talk 1380 WAOK Real Estate 101. I'm Mary Gill, and I have the honor of having in one place three retired special agent FBI officers, and they are collectively going out and trying to change the face of law enforcement by starting at the top with leaders. So this book, and I would like to talk to Dr. Green about his book, is fantastic. I started reading it already. It's called Coaching Police Leaders in the 21st Century, and I love your dedication. I'm not going to spoil all of this because people need to read this. However, I do want to read the preface, just the first bit of it, which is hugely it's hugely impactful. It says, today, more than any other time in our history, America's police are in need of effective leaders and leadership teams with progressive and realistic visions for success. Almost on a daily basis, with the help of technology, we hear or read instantaneously via social media how some police officers violate their duty as public servants by not serving with professionalism, integrity, and accountability, and the preservation of individual constitutional rights. So, Dr. Green, you there?
Yes, I'm here, Mary.
Oh, okay.
Thank you for that introduction.
Well, thank you. Ahead. This is a really great book, and I want everybody to get it and read it because it. You know what I love about this book, Dr. Green? I'm just going to say this. This is a little side thing. I'm really hard sell on books because you have to capture me. And then you have to keep me. And but I love reading. And so that this does that. This is a fantastic book. And you, everybody needs to get it. It's an easy read. You wrote it very well. So that just the general public can understand its contents, which no offense, but even some of the police leaders today would probably be challenged in some in their reading. Sorry, that has no reflection on you. I'm talking about the current one. Okay, so Dr. Green, let's talk about you starting in DeKalb. How was that?
Well, I came from, and by the way, thank you for having me on this show, and I'm honored to be here with my good friend Eddie. And I haven't met Quentin, but I've heard so much about him, and also I heard so much about you. So I moved from a very small rural environment to DeKalb County, which at that time was much larger than my little hometown. And it took a lot of, it was a little challenging. And then I was there for almost 6 years. And during that time, I was able to continue my education. And I ended up graduating from Georgia State University. And at the time, the FBI was hiring. And they were looking to hire folks who looked like me and Eddie and Quentin, and I was able to go through the long process of getting hired, and eventually I would meet Eddie about 2 or 3 years later, and we've been friends ever since.
So you have a long career in law enforcement, and a commendable one. So can you please tell me where and how did this brainstorm come into existence for you? Because I mean, there's many angles you can take, and every one of them we need. It's like a Quentin Williams with his how not to get killed by the police, and then you with the leadership training. How does this brainstorm take place? When did this come to you?
Well, that's a great question, and just think about Quentin just for a second. I think his book is a mandatory read for all people, and the fact that we are the victims of of shootings a lot more than other groups, we should certainly pay attention to it and pass it on to our children, our boys, our young men as well. So when you've been in law enforcement 30 years, you know, it becomes what you know. And as I was finishing up my doctorate, my dissertation or my project was my final goal. And so what I wanted to do was do what I had been doing best, and that was talk about law enforcement and how can I, you know, prepare something, put it together, get it out to folks, and share what I think really needs to be taking place in the 21st century, and is that transition from the way police have done things in the past to something new, and some paradigm changes, and it all starts with leadership. But what I first do is I start with the history of policing. And while, you know, if you go to, when I went to college first and you start taking criminal justice courses, it talks about how policing was started and who started it. But it fails to talk about that organized policing in our nation really started with the slave patrol. And from that, and I'm not trying to go through my entire book, but from that, this fear from people that are black and brown continues today because of that. And then you have these incidents where folks like us are, as Q said, was either accidentally being injured or killed or purposely. And let me also say that, and I know my friends feel the same way, no organized society can exist without police. And Q said it earlier as well. We need police and we need the good ones. But there are those incidents that, you know, whether it's in Charleston, North Charleston, South Carolina, Atlanta, Minneapolis, that are happening, and it just continues to resonate. And now we have this perfect storm of things happening in the country, and people are paying a lot more attention, and they're demanding a lot more. So my book tries to capture that, but in a way to say, how can we do better, starting with the people at the top? And it's written not just for police officers, it's written for the general public, the people who pay taxes for police departments, and it's written for people who do the hiring. A lot of times we hire people, and they look great on paper, but when they're in the job, they have poor people skills, and they have poor leadership skills. So it kind of addresses a little bit of all of that, Mary.
So what I love about this book, I mean, this is really great, guys. So what I love about this book is right after the preface, you go into what we're going to find in the book, which is fantastic. You go chapter by chapter, you give us a brief synopsis, and then it leads us into the book, which is fantastic. I love that. I'm really impressed with how you've outlined this book. But anyway, so there you go, guys. Coaching police leaders in the 21st century, we do need that. So what I think we should do, Dr. Green, is I think we should collectively buy a ton of them and then just send them to every police captain and chief everywhere. I think this should be required.
Obviously, I want to sell a few books, and I've tried a little bit to forward it to police chiefs and executives where incidents have occurred in their departments, not to say, here, you need this, but to say, hey, take a look at it, and maybe this may help you as you continue in your career, and once you get out of this, you know, this turns out to be a mess, what you got yourself into now. Sometimes not of their own doing, but because they're the chief, they're the leader, and whatever happens in that department, it's a reflection on them.
That's right. That's right. All right, everybody, 404-892-2703. If you have any questions for our guests, please feel free to give us a call. Deal of the Decade will come at 2 o'clock. I had to push it back because I'm excited to talk with these special agents. Real Estate 101, back in a minute. We're back, everyone. News and Talk 1380 WAOK. Real Estate 101, I'm Mary Gill, and joining me today, I have the pleasure of having Dr. Gerald Green. He is the author of the book, which I'm currently reading, Coaching Police Leaders in the 21st Century, written very well, very well. And Quentin Williams, he's a former special agent with the FBI, and Eddie Alford. I call him Eddie. It's Eduardo Alford. He is also a retired special agent with the FBI. All right. So, Dr. Green, we have some callers. Let's go to the callers first, because my mind is just teeming with questions. But, all right, we have, who do we have? Michelle. Thank you, Jamin. Michelle, how are you?
Hi, I'm well. How are you doing?
What's up? I'm doing pretty good. What's going on?
So I have a question. There's been a lot more discussions on systemic racism lately, and I was wondering what role do you all think systemic racism plays in our law enforcement?
Hey, Mary, I didn't hear the last part of her question.
What role do you feel systemic racism plays in law enforcement?
Yes.
Great question. I'll take it, or whoever wants to take it, I can take it if you want, or you can take it.
Well, I mean, Q, we can both. I mean, once you start, I can make a comment too.
So equity is a big issue, and we need to acknowledge that we have been living in a society with no equity. And by equity, we define it as systemic fairness. So without systemic fairness, we are going to have what we see on the streets. We're going to have people protesting, because ultimately that's what every human being deserves. That's what every human being requires. So if we acknowledge our history, as Dr. Green was talking about, our law enforcement industry's history is steeped in racism. Doesn't mean that those who are serving now are racist. There might be some, and we have seen that there are some, a small number, but the history is steeped in it because of the slave patrols. Those slave patrols were the incarnation of our law enforcement, our modern day law enforcement industry. We have to acknowledge it in order to move on to action. If we do not acknowledge it, we ignore it, we're going to find ourselves in this position, going in circles, chasing our tail. So that acknowledgement is what the people on the streets want. They want that coupled with action. Eddie, you can chime in as you like.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't need to say anything much more, Q. I mean, you pretty much hit the point. But I will say that, you know, the more fiber of this country was built on racism. So the young lady's question, of course, you know, there's racism, systemic racism in law enforcement. I've seen it. Q sees it. Dr. Green has seen it as well. And that really, you know, is the essence of, I had a friend of mine, we talked a little bit, I'm a little bit of a comic at heart. We have passion for law enforcement. And there are some occupations that you just can't be mediocre in. And I just think that law enforcement is one of those. And by example, I would say that the pilots that fly airplanes are another profession that you just can't afford to be mediocre in. So, yes, there is systemic racism in law enforcement. And it's going to take a concerted effort by a lot of us, a lot of the young millennials, the things that are going on right now. It's just time. It really is time for change.
Okay. Thank you, Michelle. All right, we have another caller, Todd. Hey, Todd. We have him, Jamin. Hello. Okay, is he there?
I'm talking. Can you hear me now?
No, I couldn't hear you because I lost my connection with Jamin, but how you doing, Todd?
Okay, so you can hear me now.
Surely can.
So Eduardo Alford, Quentin Williams, and Gerald Green, correct? Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Okay, can you guys all hear me too?
Yes.
Yep, okay, cool. We got you.
I have four questions for Gerald Green, one and one for Quentin Williams. And I want to give you a little bit of background before I get into it. I'm coming from the position that I've been in handcuffs unjustly by the police four times in my adult life, 93, 2002, 2010, and 2013. Don't have any alcohol abuse. All the alcohol I've drank in my entire life, you could probably put in two one-gallon jugs. No drugs, illegal, no legal drugs, so that have been on any mind-altering prescriptions, never, ever. And I've never been in an argument or a fight with the police, but I've been in handcuffs four times unjustly and five close calls, and I still don't have a criminal record and didn't have a criminal record then. So this is the position I'm coming from. I've been the black man on the scene at the time that somebody wanted to be toy tough guy. Here are my questions. Gerald Green, what did you do your dissertation on when you got your PhD so I could get to my two questions about the book?
Yes, so I did a project, and I have a doctorate. I want to make sure that you understand that, but not much different. So I did it on my book, Coaching Police Leaders in the 21st Century.
Okay, so I'm looking here at one of the subtitles where it says police culture, internal and external. And I'm not familiar with how culture could be external. That's one of your subtitles. Could you explain that to me so that I understand it?
Okay, I'm having just a little bit of a problem hearing you. Could you talk up just a little bit louder?
Is this better?
That's much better.
Okay. I'm looking at your book chapter titles right now, and I see one subtitle where it says police culture, internal and external. And in my mind, all culture is internal. So could you educate me so that I understand what you mean when you say external and you're referencing culture?
Yes, so some of the internal cultures are things that are just specific to law enforcement. The external is going to be more like your community policing relations, ethics and policing.
So you would consider the police departments extending themselves to the community part of police culture, and that would be external?
That's exactly right.
Okay. And could you give me an example? This is one of your subtitles as well, where it says use of force, getting it right. Could you give me an example of something that might be vague to the common person as to what would actually be justifiable use of force to a law enforcement agent? There's the obvious, I know. Someone's getting physically aggressive with you. That would be the obvious. But give me something that might be vague to the common person, but still is very much justifiable use of force.
Well, that's a very good question. And police officers are trained, and across this nation, we have 17,000 police departments. And use of force, I can tell you, varies from department to department. And when a police officer, for example, is out by him or herself in the late night or early morning, and they're conducting traffic stops, and they come across situations where, you know, it's a bad person that they're trying to hurt or trying to hurt someone else. And this is a very broad example, but they'll have to use of force, lethal force, if they have to. I don't know where you're going with this, but
I'm not trying to lead you anywhere.
Okay.
All right, so I got to take a break, guys, but I'm loving the conversation. So when we come back, Todd, stay with us, please, and then we can get to your next questions as well.
Okay.
All right, everybody, 404-892-2703, Real Estate 101, back in a minute. We're back, everyone. News and Talk 1380 WAOK, Real Estate 101. I'm Mary Gillen. Yes, I'm out of my lane today. The reason is because I haven't been. People have tried to talk to me about this. I've kind of stayed in my lane. You get a lot of it during the week. But I have had the honor and special opportunity to have three fantastic gentlemen with me. They are former Special Agent FBI officers and authors of books, which is fantastic. I downloaded on Kindle Dr. Gerald Green's book, Coaching Police Leaders in the 21st Century. I'm not going to get into them. Excuse me for a minute, Dr. Green, but it was $16 and change. I mean, you can barely get through the drive-thru at McDonald's for that amount of money. And it's a fantastic read. And then also the survival guide, How Not to Get Killed by the Police by Quentin Williams. So before the break, we're talking to Todd, though. Todd had, he was two questions into his three questions for Dr. Green. Okay, Todd, go ahead.
Okay, you can hear me again, Dr. Green?
Yes, I can, Todd.
Okay,
Todd,
I wanted to be clear.
Todd?
Yes.
Todd, I don't mean to interrupt you. Can we go back to your question number two? I just want to make sure that I heard it correctly and that I gave you an appropriate answer.
Your first one, the first question you answered clearly.
Question two, I believe it was on an example of when to and when not to use of force.
No, the question was, could you give me an example of what might be considered vague to the general public as being justifiable use of force, but would it be an actual justified use of force to a police officer? For example, that's why I brought up the fact that I had been in handcuffs unjustifiably four times. If any of those times had been justified, I would have an arrest record, but I don't. And it was unjustified. I consider putting somebody in handcuffs unjustifiable use of force if it's not through correct procedure. But to somebody else, that might be considered, just because you were standing there and they felt like they had a suspect in line, which would be you or me, that was justifiable use of force to put somebody in handcuffs.
Yeah, so that's right. I mean, I got not quote-unquote arrested, but I did get put in the police car for mouthing off to a police officer, mouthing off, when it really wasn't even mouthing off. I was asking, what are you doing? What are you doing?
Well, that's what I mean. How is that qualified?
He said, you're under arrest.
How does that qualify as just putting you in a police car? So that's what I'm asking Gerald Green.
Right.
Give me an example separate, because I didn't tell you what happened with me, and I'm not going to, because I don't want to tie up the broadcast. But give me something that might be vague to somebody else that, you know, like the chapter says, use of force, getting it right. So give me an example. It might be vague to the general public.
Yes. So, Todd, that's a good question. It's a very broad question, and I'm going to try to answer it for you as simply as I can. For example, a police officer is responding to a bank robbery, and the bank robbery is of an individual who fits the description, and the police stop that individual to have a conversation with him or her. And during that time period, if the officer pats the individual down and the person has a weapon, well, obviously that's enough to put him in handcuffs for the officer's safety. But let's just say he doesn't have a weapon, but it fits the description. The officer has options. He can, you know, you can stand there and have a conversation to the person who was the victim of the robbery, rides by, conducts what they call a drive-by, to identify that either that's him or not him. They can even place you in the car, and they can even place handcuffs on you. But at some point, if you're held for a certain period of time, it's more than just a stop. It becomes an arrest. Stopping giving you a traffic citation really amounts to an arrest, because you're stopped. You can't go until you get that ticket. And without knowing a lot more about what happened to you in those several incidents, they could have amounted to arrest or not. I just don't know without you know, knowing more about the situation.
Well, I wasn't speaking to myself. I wasn't speaking specifically about myself. There's just so many incidents where the police are arguing that this was justifiable force, and there's an outcry from the public. It's like, that was totally unnecessary. But then the police come back, and maybe if they end up in court about it, they end up winning because the court says it was justifiable force. So there's a confusion between, it may be confusion driven by malice, and it may be confusion driven by voluntary ignorance, but there's a confusion between the general public and the multiple municipalities that have police forces as to what's justifiable force and what's not. You know, a lot of people don't like being put in handcuffs. You know, but a lot of police officers say, well, I didn't know what you were about. I thought I should put you in handcuffs, and they consider that justified. That's what I was going to say, but I'll move on to the next thing because I got a question for Quentin. Quinn?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you. Thank you for asking me a question, Todd. What is the question?
Do you address in your book And if you did not, might you address in another at another occasion the importance of police officers not holding the next patron responsible for what their experience has been for the most previous patron? Citizen. I said patron, I meant citizen.
Yeah, I talk about how officers should treat folks in our citizenry. So with me, I, for example, when I was arrested in Newport, Rhode Island, I was an FBI agent. I was not in the state at the time of the incident that was alleged to have occurred, and I was arrested because I fit the description of somebody who put a 9mm to somebody else, and that absolutely was, it was justified to stop me. It was justified to put me in cuffs. I probably would have done it to myself too, but the issue I had with it was that when they let me go after several hours, which could have been avoided, that they just let me go. They just said, you can go now. We know you understand. And that was very painful to me because they didn't do what they should have done, which was they should have apologized. They should have tried to explain what had occurred. A lot of times, the way to handle these situations is to just give an explanation, 20 seconds, an explanation. That's what the public wants. So I do address it. I do address that, you know, citizens, our citizenry should not be held accountable for what happened previously with that officer, perhaps on a call. But we do have to understand that that does play into the dynamic at times, because law enforcement officers are human beings. So if, you know, a law enforcement officer comes from a 16-year-old young girl who just hanged herself and killed herself, and you go from that to now you have a traffic stop, there's a chance that there's still something ringing in that officer's head about what he or she just saw. What our position is, by policy, to change that so that an officer is taken off the road when they have something like that happen, something traumatic. They're taken off the road, they're given counseling, and then it's assessed whether they should go back onto the road then and there. There's nothing wrong with taking an officer off the road. They're human beings. They just saw somebody kill themselves. Maybe you shouldn't be on the road for the rest of your shift.
Right.
Rational, Quentin. That's very rational. And by the way, Gerald Green, your response was rational too, but I didn't want my question to be specific, so I wasn't trying to make, because I wasn't trying to make it hard for you. I want to say this an exit, and this is an exit. This is a suggestion, and I'm putting this out there to other people as well. I believe wholeheartedly that of the police forces in this country that operate in cities and the sheriff's departments as well, that mainly run counties and jails, I don't believe you should be allowed out of that academy until you've completed a community service volunteer project that's directly related to the well-being of the community where you're working, that requires you to do some problem solving. Like getting food at a food kitchen, that's not problem solving to me. I'm saying something like, you know, to the example, something like there's X number of vacant lots in a council ward, and there's a group that are working to label who owns these lots and to get houses or get people in those vacant houses that may be on the vacant lot. Well, I think you should have to do something to work to get out of the academy so you'll be more tuned in to the public.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. That's
absolutely
good,
Todd.
Point, Greg. Yep. Good point, Todd. Good point, everybody. Got to go to a break. When we come back, I'm going to quickly give you the deal of the decade. So please be ready and prepared for it. And then we're going to get back to talking to our special agents who are with us today. Thank you for joining us. All right, 404-892-2703, Real Estate 101, back after the break. Welcome back, everyone. News and Talk 1380 WAOK. This is Real Estate 101. I'm Mary Gill, and when you hear that, you know what time it is? It's time for our Deal of the Decade. Okay, so today's Deal of the Decade is a foreclosure. one of my favorite things, but far and few between these days. It's a home path foreclosure, which means it is owned by Fannie Mae, which also means previously there was a conventional mortgage on it. The house is renovated. Fannie Mae does that to their houses. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. It's brand new. Been painted inside and out. I'm looking at the pictures now. I know the neighborhood. It's in Cobb County. It's in one of the newer high-performing school districts, Hillgrove and Loving Good. Guys, listen to this. It's over 4,000 square feet, 5 bedrooms, 4 full baths, okay? And trying to get up here and see the description. Master suite upstairs includes private bath, huge closet, and a 3-car garage. Privacy fence surrounds a wooded backyard. It's currently available to, it's in the first view period, which means owner occupants have priority on making bids on this property. I love this property because right now the median price range in the metro Atlanta area to buy just a normal, decent home would probably be between $350. You'd struggle between $250 and $300 to find a home with difficulty, but it can be done. Anyway, this is a good deal to get a nice-sized family into a beautiful house, well-built, nice subdivision, in a higher-performing school district. All of that means that you can have practically a private school education in a public school district and put that extra money into your mortgage payment, okay? All of that right now is currently going for... hold on, I'm sorry, I'm messing up here with my little technology. Jamin, are you there? Can you hear me? All of that is currently going for $399,000. So that's a great deal. I know this foreclosure agent. He's fantastic. He's very fair. He doesn't give priority and preference to people. He does a good job. It's located at 3008 Robinson Forest Court, Powder Springs, Georgia, 30127. That's 3008 Robinson Forest Court, Powder Springs, Georgia, 30127. You need an agent to get in to make an offer, or you can call this agent and then maybe he can guide you on who you can get for representation, but you do need representation. So that's the great deal of the decade. I love it. I actually brought a family here. I remember years ago when the subdivision was brand new. This is a little bit of a story that kind of goes in line with what we're talking about. And they had a teenage son. And, you know, the teenage son was coming along like he really didn't want to come along. It was a mother and a father. And he had his little headphones on. And he wasn't paying attention. So we saw this beautiful foreclosure in this subdivision. And I was like, oh, my gosh, this is such a great deal. You guys really need to move on it. The whole nine. So they're like, oh, we don't know. So later I'm like, well, what's up with the house? What are you going to do? And the mom was like, well, my son has reservations about the neighborhood. He said people were looking at him. And I'm thinking, you mean to tell me you're going to lose out on all of this equity on a fantastic house in a wonderful neighborhood because your son says people were looking at him? It's like, we have to be there so they can see us. If we all cower, you know, into certain areas, and then we will never disperse. They will never get used to seeing us as their neighbors. And to me, in my mind, it perpetuates the cycle. But anyway, I guess we can get into that conversation with our three guests. All right, everybody. There's your deal of the decade. I'll post it to Real Estate 101 featuring Mary Gill to the WAOK Facebook page as well later on this afternoon. All right. We're going to get back to our guest, who is Dr. Gerald Green, who wrote Coaching Police in the 21st Century. Had to get back to my notes. And then also A Survival Guide, How Not to Get Killed by the Police. And we're talking with three retired FBI agents. And I guess we got to go to break. Jamin? Okay, cool. We'll get with them right after the break. If you have any questions, 404-892-2703. Real Estate 101, back in a minute.
life. I wonder, will it take me under? Imagine smoking weed in the street without cops harassing. Imagine going to court with no trial. Lifestyle cruising blue Bahama waters. No welfare supporters. More conscious of the way we raise our daughters. Days are shorter, nights are colder. Feeling like life is over. These snakes strike like a cobra. The world's hot, my son got knocked. Evidently, it's elementary. They want us all gone eventually. Trooping out of state for a plate. Knowledge, if coke was cooked without the garbage, we'd all have the top dollars. Imagine everybody flashing. Fashion, designer clothes. Lacing your click up with diamond rolls. Your people's holding dough, no parole, no rubbers. Going raw, imagine law with no undercovers. Just some thoughts for the mind. I take a glimpse into time. Watch the blimp read, the world is mine.
And I rule the world.
Imagine that.
I free all my sons. I love them, baby. Black diamonds and pearls.
Could it be, if you could be mine, we both shine.
If I rule the world.
Still living for today. In these last days until it is paradise.
Welcome back. News and Talk 1380 WAOK Real Estate 101. I'm Mary Gill, and we have three distinguished guests with us today, and we're going to take some calls right now. We have Jim Holding. How you doing, sir?
Well, Mary, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I listen to your show regularly.
Thank you. What's up?
Yeah, I got some questions for you FBI guys.
Mm-hmm.
Can I go?
Yes, please.
Okay. Now, a lot of people may not know that you FBI men are attorneys also. That's pretty much the prerequisite it used to be. Now, I don't want you to give me the attorney answer, and I don't want you to give me the co-op man answer. I want you to give me the black man answer. Should you guys and would you guys and do you guys need to be out recruiting young black men to join the military, learn to use the military arms, and all, as well as become snipers, as well as make bombs so that they may need to protect our community? What do you think? Hello?
I'll take a swipe at that. Hey, Jim?
Yes.
So are you asking me, should we be recruiting those type individuals?
Well, it seems to what happens and what they've learned is that they can co-op us quite easily, almost as easy as co-oping a dog.
But I think the first part of your question was the recruitment. Are you asking, should we be recruiting people with those skills or not?
Should you be helping to recruit young black men to join the military so they can use all weapons properly, as well as sniper weapons, as well as perhaps learn to make bombs to protect our community?
So I'll try to answer this question the best I can, and then I'll defer to my...
Well, I don't want the legalese, because I know you're an attorney, and I know you're a retired FBI. I don't want this black Sambo answer, and I don't want the legalese answer. I want the black man answer.
Hey, Jim, can I tell you something? They wanted to be here today to not give you the black Sambo answer. That's
okay,
why they wanted to be here for that. Okay. It's okay. All right.
So to do our jobs effectively, the FBI as an entity, we need people with different talents.
Speak up, please.
Talents, I said, to do our job effectively, the FBI needs individuals with a lot of different talents, whether they're engineers, whether they're pilots, whether they're explosive experts, whether they've been snipers, lawyers, or whatever. We recruit people like that to become FBI agents. And we also recruit people just for other jobs, analytical jobs and stuff as well within the Bureau. So what we do and what the FBI does is it encompasses a lot of different types of talents.
Okay, Jim, is that good?
Yeah, he gave me the major talk. He gave me the legalese, the attorney talk. Well, I'm just saying, just like Todd asked the question. Perhaps Todd did not answer the right question because, see, I'm an older man. And I do remember that the cops did not put the handcuffs on you until they told you were under arrest, sir. Will you please turn around? now the first thing they do is put the handcuffs on you. So where is there any legality, or did the whole nation pass laws that was legal because before it was not legal? Please respond.
Yes. So let me try again, Jim, is that for safety, some officers, especially if they're there by themselves, will place a person in handcuffs to be safe. And what it can constitute an arrest, it can constitute you being stopped. I'm not sure when that error was that they didn't, and that changed. And yes, the officer can tell you that yes, I'm detaining you for a few minutes till we find out if you are the person we're looking for.
I think the breakdown is in the explanation. I think that a lot of law enforcement officers feel like they can just detain you, or they can handcuff you and you just be quiet, don't ask any questions. And then you have no idea on, I had no idea. I was simply asking questions on why are you allowing to happen? And they basically said you're under arrest. So
before they put the handcuffs on you, they said you were under arrest. They did not put the handcuffs on you first. We've got to look at the legality on that. And since they're lawyers, they need to tell me is it legal or not. Yes or no?
go ahead, Jim, Dr. Green.
I want to get back to what Mary was saying, and Quentin talked about it earlier. There is some poor communication that goes with some officers and how they handle people on the street. And if we can get a better job or do a better job of communicating with someone and telling them why we stopped them, what they're under arrest for, it would help. Putting handcuffs on someone, it constitutes an arrest.
It's what, sir?
It constitutes, you know, being safe.
You're saying it's against the Constitution?
I'm not saying it's against the Constitution, and every situation is situational. And, when you're out there late at night by yourself and waiting for someone to come back you up, and it just depends, Jim. It just depends.
Oh, no. Wait. I understand what you're saying, but what I'm saying is, all right, let me give you a crystal clear example. I'm going to be real short and curt with this, okay? My neighbor down the street, about like 100, less than 100 yards, his windows got broken into, his house got broken into. So I called him, I alerted him of it, and I told him, look, man, I'm going to go down there and put some plywood up on there. I had my drill, ladder, and I had my little tools to go ahead and do that. Now, all of a sudden, a couple of crazy cops come around and they start questioning me. I did have a hammer in my hands. I threw the hammer down, and then they start questioning me. The first thing they said before they could hear me say, I'm talking to the owner. My ladder is around the side. I'm repairing his house. I'm putting plywood up. They told me to turn around and act very belligerent about it, and told me to turn around and put handcuffs on me. And then they started acting kind of ugly with it. Now, my whole thing was, if not for the fact that I had the owner on the phone, then they took my phone and they walked away about 150 yards, 170 feet, and then had a talk with the owner, and he verified who I is, who I was, and what I was doing.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, I think that there's too much discretion. I mean, that's pretty much what you're
right.
saying.
They have
too much
discretion.
Too much
leeway.
They can't make these judgment calls. They need to be accountable to a process. If the process has been deviated from, then they're liable for deviating from the process. There has to be some measure of accountability. You can't just have people out there doing anything they want and scared. Guys, here's the thing. You are so scared, and I'm not talking about you personally. I'm talking about police officers.
Sure,
you're
sure.
So scared. Why are you doing this?
Wait a minute, they're not scared.
That's the major defense. Oh, well, I was feared for my life. Oh, you know, even the Rashard Brooks situation where he knew the taser was now ineffective. Oh, he was so afraid for his life. It's like, if you're so afraid and you can't make the connection between I stood here for 40 minutes trying to incite this man to do something. You can't make the connection between, oh, my tasers now have run out and now you're going to kill somebody. There is a severe intellectual deficiency there.
Can I say this real quick, if I may? And this will put everything in perspective, okay? About 5-6 years ago, a black man who was militarily trained went down to Texas and he shot 15 people, 14 of them was cops. And I will tell you this, the fact that I expect every FBI on your panel to check it out. That after he did that for 7 days, there was not a black dog killed, a black cat, a black person, a black baby, a black woman, or a black man killed in America. This is an organized criminal situation, and it needs to be taken care of. We need brothers on there with serious backbone. And, yeah, I love it you guys are intellectual, but I need some people to go ahead and put their hands in the dirt.
Well, I'm going to post their bios, which I haven't gone into in depth, Jim.
Okay.
And
yeah.
And then you're going to be able to see that they've really had their you know, their hands in the dirt and back again. Okay? All right. You have a good day.
You too,
right,
Mary.
Thank you. 404-892-2703. We come back. We have one caller holding for you with another question for you guys. Real Estate 101, back in a minute. We're back, everyone. News and Talk 1380 WA. Okay, Real Estate 101, I'm Mary Gilling. For God knows how long I'm getting out of my lane today because I had a unique opportunity to have three retired FBI agents with me at one time together collectively to interview, to talk about their next endeavors, which is teaching leaders, teaching police leaders, which is really where we need to start, and also how to protect ourselves when we get stopped by the police, by Quentin Williams. So we have a caller holding, and he's a regular, and I want to get to him. But before we do that, Dr. Green, I bought your book from Kindle. Now, it was easy as a click, and I'm thankful for it. But I'm looking here and I'm seeing other means by which you can buy your book. Like Walmart has 5 copies left. Everybody, you need to go get those. And what is the best way you would say is that you want us to access and buy your book?
Yeah, so my publishing company is Lulu.com. And then from there, Lulu has provided issues of it to Barnes & Noble as well as Amazon. And either one of those will work. And if you're seeing it on Walmart, I'm glad it's out there at Walmart as well. So, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm glad too. I actually did access it through Amazon, and then they offered it on Kindle, and I just clicked it, and I got it. All right, that's beautiful. Thank you, Dr. Green. Now, Quentin Williams, how can everybody buy your book?
Thank you for that very much, Mary. So they can go to dedicationtocommunity.org. Dedicationtocommunity.org. And on the homepage, you just click right on and you can donate to Dedication to Community, which is a 501c3 not-for-profit. I've donated all the proceeds to the not-for-profit for this book. And so every dollar that we get for the book will be going toward the work that we're doing really globally on these issues.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I will post that to Real Estate 101 featuring Mary Gill. I already posted the deal of the decade, but I will post links to both of these books so you can access them and then go ahead and buy them. They're fantastic. I mean, we really should buy yours, Agent Williams, and just give it to our kids. Actually, I have nephews and they're listening in right now. Hey, Ethan. Evan, and you know, they're young drivers too, and it scares me. It really, do you know what? Listen, guys, this is true. Last night I went and picked up my granddaughter so she can come here and assist me this morning, as she does. And as I was driving out of her neighborhood, there was a black guy running. Do you know I was afraid for him? It's just like Jim said, he was in his own neighborhood. Yes, ideally, I think that we would love to be able to have an intellectual approach, but realistically, we're dealing with people who are just, there's no reasoning with them. They've been just endowed with just this all-encompassing authority and feel like they can do whatever they want to do and they get away with it. And I love the approach, and you all are so qualified to take this approach. But, I mean, how effective do you think that these measures are going to be, Dr. Green? Because you're dealing, I'm sorry to have to say it, but with very ignorant people.
Yeah, I think that what we need in law enforcement, certainly in the training, is to have a more pragmatic approach to dealing with people. And I can't say enough about what Q said earlier. Even when you make mistakes when dealing with someone, especially detaining them for such a long time, why not say, I'm sorry, have a lieutenant or a captain come out and apologize for what happened, explain what happened, and move forward. But it's got to start in the recruiting. And as Todd, who said earlier, your caller that called in, he left us with something that we should take with us, is that is, each recruit should be required to go out into the community that they're going to be serving and get a chance to work on a project and get a chance to know the people.
Right. Okay. Leroy, is Leroy still holding? I'm sorry. Was that
you? No, go ahead, Mary. I would say something, but let's take the call from Leroy.
Oh, okay, Eddie. hey, Leroy, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, and yourself and your guests?
Good.
Yeah, I was going to tell if y'all can hear me or not. But I have a few questions. Let's start with these two first. So when there's an accident in a private parking lot, police are not giving out tickets. They're not writing police reports. They may come, but they're doing nothing. Wendy's was a private parking lot. Rashard Brooks is dead with two cops bullets in his back. When it comes to training, why are our police chiefs and sheriffs going to Israel to get trained? Hello?
Yeah.
Anybody?
What was the last part of the question again?
Yes. Why are our police chiefs going to Israel to get trained? Well, that's a good question.
Why are our police chiefs and sheriffs being sent to Israel to be trained? I mean, we see what they do to Palestinians.
That's a good question. I can just chime in quickly. Our law enforcement leaders are engaged in training methods that sometimes are fairly creative, and those training methods aren't always necessarily provided for in America. So they do take trips to see how other methodologies are measuring up. That doesn't mean they're adopting them. It's just they're seeing how they measure up. And we have a lot of folks from abroad who come to America to be trained for the same purpose, to try to be better. It's not to try to be more militaristic. It's to try to be better, to take what others are doing and to incorporate that into one's own training. So it doesn't mean that they're adopting the stuff, wartime type tactics. It just means they're trying to learn. We have to be open-minded to try to learn from others who are doing things in creative ways so that we can incorporate that training, that education into our own system.
Thank you. Let me also add to the caller.
Oh, wait, hold on, Leroy. Hold on. Go ahead,
hey,
Eddie.
Hey, Leroy. Yeah, no, I just want to just make an extra additional comment about the dynamics of what's done outside of the U.S. as well. So, for example, to become a police officer here in the U.S., the training regimen is very short. Over in Europe, there's a two-year process for a police officer to become a police officer. So, you know, if we look at what we want to do to reimagine how we police in the U.S., you know, what we're talking about is it sometimes takes looking at what other countries do to make what we do better.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, so, all right. Did you hear that, Leroy? I heard it fine. I don't know why you didn't hear it, but you know, you might.
Absolutely right. Zero. Can I get to that next question?
Yes. Are you driving?
Okay. Yeah, okay. So the next question is this. I haven't read the book that he wrote, but Oscar Grant was laying on his stomach doing exactly what he was told. He died from a barked cop bullet in his back. What in your book would have kept him alive?
So, and I guess that's for me, for Quentin Williams, A Survival Guide, How Not to Get Killed by the Police. I wrote the book because I wanted to increase the odds of people getting home safely, with the understanding that it wasn't the sole remedy for it. The other remedy, the other piece of the equation is law enforcement officers have to be trained to serve, not to police. They have to be trained to serve, not to police. I don't use the word policing, because policing for me and for many people in communities means overseeing. We know where overseeing, where that comes from. So it's not just educating communities about what to do. We know that there are times when no matter what they do, they're still getting killed or having these interactions that are not favorable. And although there's a small number, it's still too many. And Philando Castile is another example of it. So that's why we train, and Eddie is a big part of what we do, and Dr. Green is being brought in on it too. We train law enforcement agencies globally, a lot domestically, to serve better. If you do both, if you're training law enforcement agencies and you're training communities, they can come to some meet in the middle where they can engage in a way that will be successful. And also taking into account, and I'll finish with this, the selection, training, and discipline are the three pillars of successful agencies. If you don't select the right people, it doesn't matter how much you train them up and discipline them, you're still going to have a flawed system. And it's the same with the other two pillars. You have to have all three of those things working in sync in order to have a successful agency.
Okay, we have to take a break. Dr. Green, I'm sorry, I got to go to a break.
I just wanted to add to what Quentin is saying, and he referred back to what he wrote in his book. And I think the question was, what part and what section will help police officers do better? I think for my book, coaching, I think it's the book in its entirety. I think that, and Mary said it, and I'll agree with it, that it's a must-read for police officers, police leaders, to know, to see this changing paradigm that taking place right before their eyes, and they're still stuck in the past in the way of doing things.
Right. And so, Dr. Green, I got to go to a break. I'm sorry. I got to go to a break because I'm 2 minutes over. All right, 404-892-2703, last segment with three retired FBI agents. Real Estate 101, back in a minute.
Okay. Can you hear me, Mary?
Sure can.
Mm-hmm. So first, I'd like to say thanks to you, Mary, for having us come in on your show and get you out of your lane a little bit. Much appreciated.
Mm-hmm. So thank you.
So the things that Q and I and Dr. Green are doing, you know, we feel very honored and privileged to have a platform to where we can speak to police leaders who are in charge of the men and women who police our communities. And in these, our communities are all of our kids. What scares me, I'm very, very discouraged about what I see, is the systemic racism in law enforcement. I have two sons out there driving. There's not a night that doesn't go by that I don't think about them, making sure I get a chance to speak to them the next day, but they're out, they live in life. There's a serious problem in law enforcement, and it speaks to everything, the culture of law enforcement, which is what we are looking to address. Hiring, getting these racist individuals out of our police departments. It is not going to be easy. It's going to take a long and arduous process to get that done. But we got to start somewhere. And then we connect that with what's going on in the communities. You know, so people have to to voice their opinions about what they see, how they are being treated. And the they right now are African-American males. I'm very discouraged about what I see. I've never been scared. I'm not scared now, but I am very cautious when I drive now. I'm always thinking. I mean, I'm not an agent. I'm retired. You know, most of the times I'm armed, but I often wonder about what my interaction is going to be now. So what I'd like to leave with your audience is this is our problem. And I believe, honestly, that the time is now that we have to unite. And the most important thing I want to say is you have to vote in your local elections, because it's not just the police departments where there's systemic racism. It's in the district attorney's offices, and it's in the city, the county commissioners. We have to get the right people in these positions to make an effective change.
Okay, thank you. Agent Williams, Quentin Williams, what would you like to say?
So we are now at an inflection point. This is history. We're living history. And it's going to be important for every member of society to be a part of this history. I never thought I'd see this. I thought it would probably come in a couple of generations after I'm gone. But we are living history. It's important for these voices to be heard. It's important for our every generation we have to be leaders and to lead. And it's also important for those leaders to ensure that those who are not on board be filtered out so that they're not in a position of authority over our society. This is what we do when we train law enforcement, what we do when we train communities. We work to that end. I appreciate you having us on today. It's been an incredible couple of hours here. And I know you didn't expect to have us on this long, so you extended for us because of the heft of the conversation. And I also appreciate what you're doing with the book and Dr. Green's book, too. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Thank you guys for being a part of it. Dr. Green, your parting words?
Oh, yes. Thank you, Mary. And I think my two panel guests, your two panel guests kind of summed it all up. And I would just say that history does have a way of repeating itself. And as Quentin so eloquently spoke and said, that we are living history, and we, people like myself, Eddie, and Quentin, we want to be part of that change. We want to see people change. But I will say something that I know I'm pretty sure it may be in Quentin's book, is that our young people, women, young men and women, when you're out, and it's 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock in the morning, and you have an encounter with a law enforcement officer, that is not the time to argue your point. Be respectful. Do what you're told to do. And then the next day, with your computer, you write up what happened and what you thought and how you thought your rights were violated. But not that night. Because I want to see you come home. I have two boys. I want to see them come home. I have two girls. I want to see them come home. So that is not the time to do that. Again, Mary, thank you for allowing us to be on your show.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Green. Agent Williams, Agent Alford, thank you so much, everybody, for being part of the show. I will post links to their publications on Real Estate 101 featuring Mary Gill and on the WAOK Facebook page. It has been amazing. Thank you all for joining us. Jamin, thank you for your help. You did a good job. Thanks a lot. Thank you to my assistant, Eliana, and to my amazing listening audience. News and Talk 1380 WAOK, Real Estate 101. I'll see you next week.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.